I'm Aaron Martell.
I'm the professor.
And I'm Lou Figaro.
And welcome to Ridiculous Rock Record Reviews, a podcast where we talk about and review a rock album of our choice. This episode is part five and the final episode of a special album series where we take an artist and review their entire studio discography in order of release. This particular series is called On the Beat with the Police, and we even have special theme music for this series composed and performed by Matt Fleming. Thanks, Matt. So that means we're going to be reviewing The Police's fifth and final studio album from 1983, Synchronicity. So, Professor, in case this is a new listener's first time with us and this band, give us a quick overview of your history with The Police and where do you come in with this particular album?
Well, I mean, I grew up in the 80s, and when I really started getting into music, they were the biggest band around at the time. And I'm always fascinated by how music can move you emotionally and mentally, or how it immediately, and in this case, unexpectedly, transports you back in time. Listening to this album took me back to my senior year in high school. 1984 is when I graduated. I'm old. To be exact, around the same time of year, autumn. MTV had played exclusively videos at that time. Parachute pants, straight leg jeans, sleeveless t-shirts, hair gel, white sneakers. You know, that's kind of what was around. I did have the coolest jacket back then, too. Seemed like that everyone had a new car, that plastic molded 80s models. Techno computer world had just started. It was just in its earliest stages. And I got this album on my cassette for my 17th birthday. And I cannot relay how big this album was at the time. It was everywhere. It was a time that was a creative outburst in art and music. U2's War, Def Leppard's Pyromania, Holy Diver, She's So Unusual, Let's Dance, Speaking in Tongues, Peace of Mind, Shout at the Devil, Bark at the Moon, 90215, Undercover, Rebel Yell, Mental Health, Principle of Moments, Sports, and a million other albums came out at this time. We were bombarded with videos and good music constantly, so it seemed. Just that from that list, how many of those albums are classic, iconic, or even career-defining works? I remember one specific fall evening listening to this on my non-Sony Red Walkman, and I'd heard the singles. You couldn't get away from them. And I wanted to see what all the hype was about. And I had this album, this cassette was given to me. The cassette case had lyrics, something I'm sure I'd have trouble with reading right now. But I remember I was listening to the cassette and reading along with the lyrics. And I was struck at how intelligent the songs were lyrically. And that's kind of what got me on this album. This was my first album that I got into. And then I went back. And I can't remember who gave this to me for my birthday. I think it was my cousin's boyfriend at the time who was really big into The Police. And I remember him really loving Ghost in the Machine when it came out. But that's my story.
All right. Lou?
Yeah, I think I've said it before. I never really got along or liked The Police. And the band isn't really that great either. They're another band I felt was force-fed to me by MTV. And I mean, they got some catchy tunes, but nothing I really wanted to go out of my way to listen to. Not that I had to go in the back when this was out, I never really had to go out of my way to actually get it force fed into my head. I actually own this record. I got it figuring I'd do a deep dive along with the others for $5 at a flea market after I haggled the crack addict down from $5 each that he wanted. But hey, it came in handy when it came to this series. But that's really where I come in with this is it's been in my life the whole time, but I've never really had to endure the whole thing all at once until now.
Oh, that's telling.
Spoiler alert. As I've said on previous episodes, I discovered the Police through a couple of their music videos, and I got Ghost in the Machine on cassette in 1982. So the next year when Synchronicity came out and Every Breath You Take was fucking everywhere, smack dab in the middle of Michael Jackson Thriller mania, no less, I was already well on the beat with the Police, so I got this cassette shortly after it was released. Here are some basic facts about this record, lifted from Wikipedia. Synchronicity is the fifth and final studio album by British rock band The Police, released on June 17, 1983, on A&M Records. It was produced by The Police and Hugh Padgham, and was recorded from December 1982 to February 1983 at AIR Montserrat, as well as at Le Studio, Morin Heights, Quebec, Canada. It reached number one on the UK Albums Chart, as well as number one on the US Billboard 200 chart, and is certified platinum in the UK, as well as 8 times platinum by the RIAA. And here's the band's lineup card one more time. We have Sting on bass guitar, keyboards, and lead vocals. Andy Summers on guitar, backing vocals, and lead vocals. And Stuart Copeland on drums and backing vocals. And incidentally, we're going to be reviewing the original cassette and CD version of the album that has an additional track that the vinyl version doesn't have. Okay, let's get on the beat with the Police one more time and commence a track-by-track analysis of this album. We start things off with Synchronicity 1, written by Sting. Prof, what do you think?
So this is the song that got me right away. Lyrically, the connection to the butterfly effect, the idea that small things can have non-linear impacts on a complex system, was clear to me. With one breath, with one flow, you will know synchronicity. Okay, so I was 17 and wondering what the hell he was talking about, which was the theory of Carl Gustav Jung, a Swiss psychologist who founded analytical psychology. Or Jungian psychology, concepts such as the anima and animus, or the unconscious gender sides, part of the collective unconsciousness that he talks about, archetypes, extroversion, introversion, psychological complexes. He shared these views with his widely influential friend and contemporary, Mr. Sigmund Freud. Just think Myers-Briggs, that's what he's really talking about. Jung's synchronicity is a concept used to describe circumstances that appear meaningfully related, yet lack a causal connection. In contemporary research, synchronicity experiences refer to one's subjective experience that coincidences between events in one's mind and the outside world may be causally unrelated to each other, yet have some sort of unknown, meaningful connection to them. Like, they're fucking crazy. So, but anyway, it got to me. It was kind of cool. Sting came across this concept, by the way, of Arthur Koester's The Roots of Consciousness, a little light reading for him. The book introduces theories of parapsychology, ESP, psychokinesis, melding a relationship between physics and time and the paranormal. Spooky shit. A connecting principle linked to the invisible, almost imperceptible, something inexpressible, science insusceptible, logic so inflexible, casually connectable, nothing is invincible. Okay, great. It just seems kind of cool that he just kind of threw all this together, and it seemed like it made sense to a 17-year-old. The one thing that struck out to me on this one was his use of Spiritus Mundi, which is a little Latin for Sting to show off a bit, which is its literal translation is the spirit of the world. However, Sting is most likely referring to Yeats's meaning, which is each human mind is linked to a single and vast intelligence, and that is the intelligence causes certain universal symbols to appear in individuals' minds. The idea is similar to Jung's concept of the collective unconsciousness. And Gordon is such a little well-read lad, isn't he? Mm-hmm. To boil it down and put it into other words, he could be talking about the internet in 1983. So this could all boil down to porn, because that's what's all over the internet. If you act as you think the missing link, smart as the song lyrics are, and yes, I sought all of this out in my own little way, way back when in 1983, too. It was just more time consuming and involved. It had to do with the dictionary and a few encyclopedias, all from my local library. The song itself bangs to me. That driving beat, the keyboard played by Sting and Andy Summers, summer slashing guitar licks. It's a banger of a guitar riffless song that hooked me right away. It was witty, and what's not to love? And going back to the guitar thing, that's probably what got me not really into them that quickly, because it's the guitar is such a non-instrument in this band. It's more about the bass and it's more about the beat, and the guitar is just kind of like an accent. It's so deep, it's so wide, you're inside synchronicity. Yeah, okay. I like the tune.
Lou?
Well, it's got the frenetic 80s keys and a band that sounds more synthetic than real this time. Copeland's almost challenging the plastic-like main rhythm, the keys. Is that keys or is it Andy Summers? Is Andy Summers even on this? Sting nails himself to Stu's right foot, and that's if he's even playing bass here. I can't tell if it's the keys giving the bass line or it's a strings bass. The liner notes give absolutely no info, and neither does Wikipedia on it. This song is, what, 3:23? And I start looking at my watch like a little over halfway through this. It's not a good sign.
Sting discovers the Oberheim DSX sequencer and uses it as a nervous pulse.
Aha!
It almost sounds like bouncing vibraphone notes. And I read that the band were struggling how to make this song work, and they quit recording for the day. And it was one of those deals where Sting snuck in back into the studio at night and finished the whole thing himself. And they all came in the next day and said, "What the fuck, dude?" But he had it done. Stuart Copeland comes in with his distinctive drum tone and a fast, straightforward beat. Sting's bass is very basic. It stays low and basically just grounds the tune, while Andy Summers supports the track with his signature chorused and phased guitar licks that just kind of fade in and out of the ether. The vocals are layered and sound like a chorus of policemen, and the lyrics are heavily inspired by Swiss psychiatrist Carl Jung. I am not going to say anything about that because the prof covered that in more detail than I could even imagine. So I'm not touching the lyrics on this one. The prof nailed it. I dig this. It gets the record off to a fast start, and it was the second single from the album, released only in Japan. The next track is Walking in Your Footsteps, written by Sting.
50 million years ago, you walked upon the planet's sun. Thought of all that you could see, just a little bit like me. Walking in your
Lou, your thoughts?
Well, I'm walking through New Orleans. Walking through New Orleans. 3 minutes and 30 seconds of absolute filler.
Prof.
It's got that jungle beat and that weird flute, like we've just been transported into a South American rainforest. It's a droning song about dinosaurs with a not-so-concealed no-nukes message for good measure. Thanks, Sting. The song drones on and really goes nowhere musically. Very world music stuff to me. It serves as a more of a musical landscape. It does convey a certain vibe, and some of Sumner's weird guitar passages are pretty tasty, especially at the end. But that's about it.
Another sequencer tune. And actually, it was the first one Sting worked on. Plus, you get the pan flute notes, which is kind of weird. This is more sparse and less dense in the opening track, though. The synth sounds like marimba or steel drum notes to my ears, and the bass just kind of bounces along underneath while the guitar makes phased volume swell comments. The only thing I can detect Copeland doing at all is tapping his drumsticks together to create a polyrhythm for the track. I do dig the vocal melodies. Sting sings gently while gaining urgency as he goes along, and lyrically he's talking to a brontosaurus, comparing the extinction of the dinosaur species to the possibility of the human race following suit if we engage in nuclear war. Ahaha, the paranoid 80s. I dig this track too. It's experimental, and for me, it works. The following track is Oh My God, written by Sting. Professor, let's have it.
Well, this song fades in, which I always found kind of odd. It's got that bouncy modern jazz fusion thing to it. Heavy bass. It's a good foreshadowing of Sting's first solo album's work. Copeland is showing off with his drumming. The song is bass-driven with punctuations by Copeland and some ethereal synth swells. Summers is playing some very 80s arpeggiated notes, the very 80s guitar trope. That is, I think he may have actually introduced this to the mainstream. And for that, he should be keel-hauled. But that's another podcast episode. Mm-hmm. Take the space between us and fill it up some way. So he's talking to God that he doesn't really believe exists at all. Okay, great. Yeah, kind of a filler tune.
Lou?
Yeah, it was interesting. It is interesting. It fades in like an old film noir movie. This groove is uncharacteristically tolerable. No clue what he's howling on about.
This is a beloved album by so many people.
But it's true. I have no clue what he's howling on about. And again, halfway through, I'm just bored, ready to move on. They do go off on an interesting breakdown, and then that devolves into just the song petering out.
To me, this one sounds like a reject from the Ghost in the Machine sessions. It does have a cool, upright bass line from Sting, while Summers plays a burbling guitar part underneath, along with phase guitar whooshes that fade in and out. There's a honking saxophone all over this bitch towards the end of the song that recalls Ghost in the Machine 2, though I read that parts of this track originated in a Sting song called 3 o'clock Shot from the Police's previous incarnation, Strontium 90. Lyrically, it sounds like Sting's got some daddy issues of the divine kind. He's got questions, and he ain't getting any answers. And he feels disconnected from God and asks the deity to fill up the empty space he feels inside himself that lies between them. Wondering if the big guy's sleeping on him or what. Good luck with that, Gordon. And for some odd reason, he quotes his own line from Every Little Thing He Does Is Magic. Go figure. I don't know. This one's okay. Kind of meh. The bass saves it for me, I guess. The next track is Mother, written by Andy Summers. Lou, what the fuck?
Is this Andy Summers doing his best David Byrne impression? I wish he'd slap himself in the forehead hard. This is some waste of time, and it just puts me in a bad place.
Prof.
Well, I swear, I think that Andy put this on there just to piss off Sting. And he just did it to just jack with him, and that's what it seems like to me. The song, if it could be called one, sucks. The raving of a man and his dominant mother, okay. I don't believe any girl is going out with this lunatic like he says in his lyrics. Pass.
Well, the telephone is ringing. It's that mother song again. The telephone is ringing. It's that mother song again.
Aaron Stinky Stinker? You bet your ass it is, my friend. The telephone is bleeding. It's that fucking mother song again. Oh. Oh.
You did it better than he did.
It was a little more in key.
The following track is Miss Gradenko, written by Stuart Copeland. Prof, what do you say?
No, it's the bouncy 80s Cold War song about the commies and how bad they are. Poor Miss Gradenko. Don't tell the director I said so, but are you safe, Miss Gradenko? Boy, this song gets on my nerves quick. Mm-hmm. Just the way it kind of keeps going over and over and over that. It almost could be a Steely Dan song, though, musically. But they'd have snarkier lyrics than this. Yeah, this if it wasn't just for the way it just kind of keeps repeating over and over, I can't handle this one. Sorry.
Lou.
A cyclic arpeggiated fingered guitar pattern. Convoluted syncopated beat. Sound like a world music Sesame Street chant turned inside out. This doesn't put me in a comfortable place either. And although it's catchy, it's too weird for me. Although I'll take it over that last song.
So Copeland finally gets a bone thrown to him like Summers did on the last track, and he turns in this snooze fest. We get clean guitar arpeggios, a meandering beat, and once again, the most interesting part is Sting's lightly galloping bass. Summers plays one of the worst guitar solos I've ever heard, a noodly, uninspired piece of dreck that sounds like he's bored. Copeland said the lyrics were inspired by a picture of a lady in a Russian uniform, and he imagines a secretary at the Kremlin who fears nuclear war like our dinosaur man in Walking in Your Footsteps, and she writes a note about it that could potentially get her in trouble. To me, this is the definition of meh. The next track is Synchronicity 2, written by Sting. Lou, you like this one?
It starts out with Sting's signature howling, but this one is miles better than the previous Drek that's polluted half this record so far. Although this song is called Synchronicity 2, it's got nothing to do with the former rhythmically. It's a completely different song. But what's interesting is the chorus is sung as a verse, with only that one line being slightly repeating, it only slightly changing. This is probably the least repetitive song that the Police do, and I'd have called it Many Miles Away. Were they just trying to be clever?
Prof.
Well, it starts with that radio signal, and am I the only one that wished the guitar, especially at the beginning, before the EOs, was a lot higher in the mix? I want to hear what he's doing with that. It sounds like he's strangling it. I do like the bass and the drums. And what is that low drone that happens when the song kicks in? Is that bass or is that a synth? It's just that.
That sounds like a synth.
Yeah. Lyrically, this one paints a happy picture. Another suburban family morning, grandmother screaming at the wall. Have to shout above the din of our Rice Krispies. We can't hear anything at all. Mother chants her litany of boredom and frustration, but we know all her suicides are fake. And all of this has something to do with the Loch Ness Monster for some reason. I never got the connection. And daddy whose job sucks, his superiors suck, his commute sucks. Another working day has ended, only the rush hour hell to face. Packed like lemmings into shiny metal boxes, contestants in a suicidal race. This last part really got me, though, is the daddy grips the wheel and stares alone into the distance. He knows something somewhere has to break. He sees the family home now looming in the headlights, the paint upstairs that makes his eyeballs ache. I saw that while listening to this song now, and it gave me flashbacks to my first marriage and home life. And I'm not joking, as unwelcome as those flashbacks were. At the time in 83, I thought this and the first song were the best on the album. I like this one a little bit more. It was a little bit more edgier and raw. But man, I can't stand when I've heard the live version, and I couldn't stand the video that they did for it. It's just, I like the song on the album, and we'll go as far as that.
And now we have my very favorite song this band ever did. The rhythm is up-tempo and propulsive. The bass and drums keep pushing the tune forward. But the MVP of this track for me is Andy Summers. His guitar feedback squeals at the beginning, and his harder-edged licks give this a weird, haunting presence that sells this one for me. I fucking love that phrase that ends each line in the verses. Sting also delivers an amazing vocal. He's part shouting and growling out the lyrics while still providing some memorable melodies, and that keeps the nervous tension high throughout the song. Now, I admit these lyrics confused the fuck out of me for a long time, but through my crack internet research, I have come to find out that there are two parallel stories being told here that are supposedly connected through synchronicity. An ordinary guy who's got to deal with grandmother screaming at the wall, a wife who threatens suicide, a factory job that sucks and feels like a humiliating kick in the crotch, and he feels trapped and ready to snap. And the second story is literally about the Loch Ness Monster crawling out of the slime and swimming to the surface of the lake. How are these two tales connected? Fucked if I know, and Sting ain't telling.
It's synchronicity.
I love this track from the moment I heard it on the radio, and it was the fifth and final single that reached number 17 on the UK singles chart and number 16 on the US Billboard Hot 100 chart. Like Lou said, many miles away. So let's flip the imaginary record over and drop the imaginary needle on Every Breath You Take, written by Sting. Professor, what about this?
Oh, this is the song we didn't know was about stalking. Gordon, 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 Gordon. For shame. This song, in particular, this video, was ubiquitous on MTV. So much so that I can see just the first few seconds of the black and white shot of the cigarette in an ashtray, and I'm immediately triggered. I can answer the age-old question about earburn. How many times of listening to a song does it take before you get sick of it? My answer is always going to be this song and most of Phil Collins' output in the early 80s. I can't stand this tune. I couldn't even get through it to listen to this. Mm-hmm. I was done. I was like, oh, I can't. No, I can't do it. It's those first couple of notes. No.
Lou.
See, now I don't feel so bad. That riff that made Sting $1 billion. And it was actually Andy Summers that wrote it. I don't think he got a dime. It's an infectious tune sung by a stalker in the first person. This is pop radio gold, and I absolutely fucking hate it. It's never appealed to me, and I actively avoid it when it comes on.
On the surface, this song is simplicity itself. It came to Sting in the middle of the night while he was in Jamaica, and he woke up, sat at the piano, and wrote it in 30 minutes, supposedly. Copeland's drum part was combined from separate overdubs of each percussive instrument, and the band battled over this song in particular, with Sting and Copeland actually coming to blows over it. Over what? I don't fucking have any idea. The rhythm is simple and straightforward. It doesn't groove. It just moves along. But, like Lou said, what makes the song is Summers' plunky and echoed arpeggiated chords that gently flow over the rhythm track. Summers for MVP again. As the track progresses, there are background synthesizers and piano notes dinging in the bridge that are subtle. They don't take over the music, but they do make the track richer. And then, of course, Sting's vocals are mostly light and airy and give the deceptive impression that this is a simple love song, which is how so many people interpreted the lyrics. Nope, we've all said this. It's about a stalker keeping a close eye on his ex. And it's revealed in the bridge where Sting's voice rises. Since you've gone, I've been lost without a trace. I dream at night, I can only see your face. I look around, but it's you I can't replace. I feel so cold and I long for your embrace. I keep crying, baby, baby, please. It was inspired by Sting leaving his first wife, Frances Tumulty, for her best friend and next-door neighbor, Trudy Styler, and the controversy that situation generated. Now, I don't think I need to tell you that this song was such a monster it ate Tokyo. In 2019, it was hailed as the most played song in radio history. It makes all sorts of greatest song lists, and the band knew they had a hit when they recorded it, though Stuart Copeland still dislikes the arrangement to this day. So Stuart Copeland's with you guys. This was the first single which reached number one on the UK singles chart, as well as number one on the Billboard Hot 100 chart. And I'm tired of it too. The following track is King of Pain, written by Sting. Lou, lead us off.
In Dante's Inferno, it's explained that there are nine levels of hell, all progressing in intensity depending on what the sinner did in his earthly life and what the kind of person he was. I truly believe that the ring specifically for ticket scalpers and puppy mill operators has this song blasted at them for an eternity.
Prof.
Well, it's got that very 80s thing, but I always regarded this song as like a second cousin to Invisible Sun. The subject matter is kind of similar. It's going to be wild for Lou to hear this one, but this song, more than any other, was immediately clear to me. This was more like music as art. Its sparse beginning, the repeating piano passage, and the single marimba beat, drone-like and monotonous, continues and slowly builds throughout the first verse. There's a little black spot on the sun today. Same old thing as yesterday. By the second verse, the band kicks in. Sting plays a cool and busy bass line. Copeland and his active snare beat, and Summers with his weird childlike arpeggiated notes and the chord slashes, it's all instantly identifiable as the Police sound. Plus, the marimba's playing floatingly all over it. I like how they use space in this song. One more musical point, Copeland's cowball strike just before the second pre-chorus. To me, that's perfection. That's the best part of the song to me. There's a king on a throne with his eyes torn out. There's a blind man looking for a shadow of doubt. And it sounds like that there's a proper, albeit very brief, guitar solo in this. Then again, there's that space with the synth only swells. There's a little black spot on the sun today. The same old thing as yesterday. The thought-filled lyrics paired with the building music and the spacing paints a rich pastiche of morose despair and anguish. To me, this is the best song on the album as I listen to it today. Not back then, but sorry, Lou.
There's a little black spot on the sun today.
Edith Bunker singing it.
There's a little black spot on the sun today.
You've ruined it for me. I'll never think of it without eating.
Piano, bass, vocals, and cowbell, baby, with a few eerie sound effects, carry us through the first verse and chorus, and then the drums kick in, along with plinky guitar notes that turns into palm-muted chords in the chorus. Like you said, Prof, there's a sparse feel to this that lends a little gravitas to the vocals. And once again, Sting steps up to deliver memorable melodies and a catchy chorus. This originally had a dense kitchen sink arrangement to it, but Sting thought it sounded like shit. So he and producer Hugh Padgham stripped it back and kind of shaped it into what it is now. You're right, Prof. It's art. Lyrically, it's also inspired by Sting's then recent separation from his first wife, and it's filled with evocative imagery. A little black spot in the sun, a black hat caught in a treetop, dead salmon frozen in a waterfall, a butterfly trapped in a spider's web, a skeleton choking on a crust of bread, and others. It captures perfectly the depressive state that the narrator, aka Sting, feels. This is one of my favorite Police tracks, as I always identified with it, unfortunately, and it was the fourth single overall, as well as the second U.S. single that reached number 17 on the U.K. singles chart, as well as number 3 on the Billboard Hot 100 chart. The next track is Wrapped Around Your Finger, written by Sting. Prof, what do you say?
Okay, every time I hear this song, two things stand out. First, I picture them in white cotton linen, Miami Vice Saint-Tropez beach clothes, barefoot with sunglasses, dancing around in slow motion in a pitch black room surrounded by candles. How the song starts so languidly really evokes those images. The bell-like synth sounds and the Eastern guitar playing over that snare and hi-hat playing, which is actually pretty good for the snare and hi-hat. The song is basically the Sorcerer's Apprentice and how he turns the tables on his master, allowing himself to be wrapped around his master's fingers only to gain knowledge and develop a plan to defeat him, all from the apprentice's perspective. Scylla and Charybde, Mephistopheles, and Alabaster all got name-checked, and yes, they all caused young Ray to crack the books yet again. The Scylla and Charybdes is from Homer. It's about a six-headed sea monster and a giant whirlpool between Sicily and the Italian mainland, associated with the proverbial advice to choose the lesser of two evils, several idioms like between the devil and the deep blue sea, between a rock and a hard place. That's all that means. Mephistopheles, I always thought was Satan himself, but no, it's not. It's from Faust, the demon acting as the devil's agent. And then alabaster, which is a translucent gypsum stone used for carvings, used in ancient Egypt and Greece, similar to meerschaum, but denser than soapstone. It's kind of cool because you can put a light in it and it'll looks like it's glowing. Back to the song, it's haunting and captivating. It draws you in like a spell that is broken at exactly 4 minutes and 33 seconds with that jank note by Summers plays in the outro. And you all know what I'm talking about. It makes me laugh every time. I like to imagine that he did it to piss Sting off and throw the proverbial fly in the ointment, so to speak. I can take this song and leave it, but I just that note always makes me laugh.
I always thought that was a bass note.
Oh, no, it's his. He's like,
I know exactly what you're talking about. Lou.
I'll admit it had a cool video the first 1,000 fucking times I saw it. Watching a girl run around in slow-mo, knocking candle stands over, creating a hazardous workplace environment. Sophomoric jokes about finger banging aside. I like the whole molasses feel that the song has. It's got a relaxed, sinister tension, sort of like a humid summer day. Hint of cool breeze coming in every so often. This is the one song I appreciate on this album. And Ray, you're right. Copeland's drumming is what keeps me coming back to this. There's always something to listen to as he fights and pulls this rhythm away from the rest of the band. I like it. It's a good tune.
Well, it's the longest track on the album. The Police finally return to a reggae-flavored rhythm, with Copeland turning in some nice hi-hat work and the bass line having a choppy reggae feel to it. Summers, as usual, is a painter adding textures with his guitar phrasing, except for the choruses, where he plays multiple stacked guitar parts and thickens the soup. Though he later said he never cared much for this song. There are synth melodies that pepper the track that sound vaguely like ringing bells, and the whole tune has an eerie, slow-motion vibe to it that's quite hypnotic. It's also reflected in the video that we've been referencing. The lyrics reference Greek mythology, as well as the stories of Faust and the Sorcerer's Apprentice. The prof covered all that. Once more, the Police come up with a chorus that'll stick with you. And this haunting track was the second UK single and the fourth US single that reached number 7 on the UK singles chart and number 8 on the Billboard Hot 100 chart. The penultimate track is Tea in the Sahara, written by Sting.
We have this strange obsession. You have the means in your possession. Tea in the Sahara with you. Sahara with you. The young man agreed he would satisfy their need, so they danced for his pleasure with a joy you could not.
Lou, what do you got to say about this?
Well, this is a more polished version of like the jam tune that they're famous for padding all their records out with. Against the sparse thump of Sting's index finger, Copeland contains himself to a lightly attacking his hi-hat as his foot mimics the space reggae bass line. Andy Summers brings out atmospheric echoed flourishes and scrapes as Sting's crooning like a Rat Pack singer. I'll take it.
Professor.
Immediately, this song transports me to a 1920s or 30s British Saharan expedition. Everyone's dressed in white, sitting alongside a campsite with Laurence Olivier in a pit helmet, trying to have a dignified English tea in the afternoon in a barren and harsh environment. That's what it sounds like to me. Only Sting's version has a sinister Anne Rice quality. Like his sisters, a witch's coven, and he are going to steal a young man's soul. But the intended victim escapes, and the sisters die waiting for his return, and their cups are still full of sand. A sinister, hypnotic, haunting song with an obscure cautionary tale to end the album. I like the touch, how the song fades. Yes, slowly, and the guitar flashes back a few times. It's kind of cool. It seems to go on a little bit longer than you think. But I had the cassette, and I didn't know that this was intended to be the end of the album. I didn't know that until I started to read and research for this review. Hmm. The cassette has a bonus track that I didn't know was a bonus track that I like better than this one.
Sting loves this track. The band seemed to be a big fan of it, and it bores me to fucking tears. Tears in the Sahara. Yeah, it's moody, with Sting playing a redonkulously simple bass line over Copeland's hi-hat swishes, and Summers doing what he called a wobbling cloud volume swell effect on the guitar that makes the notes float along and fade away. Sting is our storyteller. And he's inspired by the book The Sheltering Sky by Paul Bowles. In the book, there's the story of an old Arab legend about a prince who agrees to have a tea party in the Sahara Desert with three sisters, and they dance around and have a great time. And when it's over, the prince promises the sisters he will return to have tea with them again, but he never comes back, and the sisters continually show up and wait for him. This thing moves with the speed of a fucking sloth, and yet Sting thought the band always played it too fast. As far as I'm concerned, if they never played it at all, I'd have been okay with that. And that brings us to the final track, Murder by Numbers, written by Sting.
If you can slip a tablet into someone's coffee, an inner voice, an awful lot of mess, because it's murder by numbers. 1, 2, 3, it's as easy.
How about this last one, Prof?
Well, Copeland's hi-hat and his rim shots on the snare kind of start this one for the first 20 seconds before Sting's raspy voice starts with, "Once you've decided on a killing, first you make a stone of your heart. And if you find that your hands are still willing, then you can turn a murder into art." The piano, the bass, and the guitar all fall, rumbling, rolling, and chugging along. By the choruses, Copeland's rim shots are replaced with his distinctive snare. Because it's murder by numbers, 1, 2, 3. It's as easy to learn as your ABCs. not the most complicated lyric I've ever heard, but it gets the point across. The song goes through the template of one's first murder to a murderer as a coping mechanism. First, you must try a twosome or a threesome, and you can bump off every member of your family and anybody else you find a bore. What the hell? Why not? Ultimately, you can become a mass murderer via becoming an elected official. Now you can join the ranks of the illustrious in history's great dark hall of fame. Okay. It's a anti-war, question the government and the Cold War and social imperialism battle cry of a song. But it's a damn good one, too, and I like it.
Lou.
Well, as if the regular record wasn't enough, we decided to prolong the torture by including one more fucking bonus track. I will give it this. It's recorded well, and so is the whole record, actually. It's almost like a reference record, like Asia would be. Really, really good detail in the recording. The detail in the drums are masterclass in miking and recording. Really good stuff. Sting's lazy vocal is the melody and bass line, and an equally lazy guitar part float over the top of a complex drum beat laid down by my favorite Oysterhead drummer. Somehow it all meshes and works, and it's easily better than either of the two songs not written by Sting on the first side. It would have been a better record if they dropped one or both of those tunes and included this one on the LP, the proper album.
So the band caps off the record and their career with this jazz rock dud. Steely Dan, this is not. Copeland is the hero here. His beat is complex and interesting, and the other two deliver what I liken to oral codeine, with the clean jazzy chords and the bass moving like molasses below. Now, Sting tries gamely to sell the lyrics, which are a serial killer 101 manual, because everybody knows that murder is ABC, easy as 1, 2, 3. I mean, I suppose they're clever and kind of humorous, but all I hear when this track comes on is the direction Sting's solo career would take after this, which in my opinion was largely, in the words of George Carlin, as boring as watching flies fuck. Now the track by track is over, we'll get into our final thoughts and album ratings. For you new listeners, the rating is a 0 to 5 system, with 5 being a favorite album of ours, all the way down to a 0, which is Mother on an endless loop. Professor Permi, what are your final thoughts on Synchronicity?
Well, for me, because this is the only one that I actually knew all of before we started doing this, I just knew the hits off the other ones. This is their best album to me. This is their most cohesive, and it's really Sting's first solo album, which of course now is really easy to see, although I remember Andy Summers' comment on VH1 a few years ago, probably more like 20 by now, where he was on some game show that they had, and he said, "I'm just waiting for Sting to come back," indicating that what he and Copeland both had maintained many times, they never really talked about an official breakup. They just sort of just stopped. Those two were both waiting for Sting to, hey, let's start back up again, and he never did. Until what, 2006? Did they come back in 2006 or 7, somewhere
seven.
Around?
Yep, 7.
Yeah. 7, yeah, I saw that at the Garden. It was fun. It was a fun show. I was totally entertained. The Garden was bouncing, too.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, they were a huge band at the time. And as fans and as new fans that they had gained after this multimedia barrage of this album, we were all kind of left wondering what happened. And then Van Halen and Roth split and everything went haywire, meaning that the explosion of creativity at the early 80s kind of dissipated and went away. But I still like this album. I don't like all of it, but I'm still, because it's, like I said, to me, it's their best one that they put out. I'm going to give this one a 4.
Lou.
Have I mentioned I wasn't a fan of this band?
A few times.
Did I mention that I think Sting is in the group of pompous, self-righteous douchebag frontmen like Bono and Morrissey and the like? I think he's got an alien ability to write a catchy hook and hang on to it like it's manna from heaven. Even if it's not my particular cup of tea, I respect the talent. Stuart Copeland is a master of the kit, pushing what you can fit into a reggae time signature without it all sounding cluttered and too busy. And Andy Summers, well, he makes some nice sounds with all those little pedals he's got. as with other records, this one has its moments in the sun, but the hits are where it's at again. The Police are a greatest hits band. Their deep tracks are throwaways for the most part, and they write for the single. And I'll give this record a three based on the mega hits that it produced. There's no denying that Sting hit a home run again with Synchronicity 2, Wrapped Around Your Finger, King of Pain, and to a lesser extent, Murder by Numbers. But the rest fail in comparison. It would have made a great EP or dropped the two non-Sting pen songs on the side A and include Murder by Numbers, and it would have picked up a rating. It's a 3.
I'm just going to come right out and say it. Synchronicity is my least favorite Police album, which isn't to say that it's bad. The singles are all fantastic songs, but unlike the other Police records, the surrounding tracks on this one, to my ears, are of a significant lesser quality. This is the sound of a band that was held together by the most fragile of bonds. They truly didn't like each other by this point, so much so that they needed to be separated from one another and recorded their tracks in separate rooms, even when they were recording live. The sessions were done in 6 weeks, were tension-filled, and Hugh Padgham, acting as both producer and mediator, nearly quit the project in frustration. The album continued the Police's experimentation with world music influences while downplaying the reggae sound that characterized much of their earlier work. As opposed to the previous album, Ghost in the Machine, the band was going for a more simple, stripped-back, less dense sound, and that's reflected in the sense of open space that many of these tracks feature. The album cover was designed by Jeff Aeroff and Norman Moore and depicted three rows of photographs of the band members highlighted by red, yellow, and blue stripes. The cover was released in 36 different configurations with different pictures and varying which color stripe was in which row. When it was released, the album was very well received by critics and commercially it blew up, making the Police one of, if not the biggest band in the world in 1983. The band toured the album successfully around the world, but that would be all she wrote for this group, as they tried half-heartedly to begin sessions for a sixth album in 1986 that soon fell apart and the Police quietly dissolved. All three members went on to have successful careers post-Police, and the band did reunite for a 2007-2008 reunion tour, but those old tensions rose up again and the band members went their separate ways when the tour was completed, thus ending the saga of the Police. I get why this record is so popular. The hits really do deliver the goods, and Every Breath You Take has proven to be timeless for some reason. But for me, it's only half a great album. I give Synchronicity a 3, and hey, we've completed another album series. It's time now to get off the beat, but this is a band and discography I have always enjoyed and will always continue to enjoy. I always go back to it. The music holds up. And that's going to do it for this episode. You can find this podcast on all the podcasting platforms wherever you listen to them. If you like what you hear, please subscribe or follow the podcast and leave us a review. If you'd like to contact us directly, we can be reached at RidiculousRockRecords@gmail.com or also on the Ridiculous Rock Record Reviews Facebook page, where there's a link to hear each podcast. We're also on Twitter at R4PodcastAaron and Instagram under R4Podcaster. If you feel the podcast has value and would like to make a contribution to support it, please head over to Patreon and the Ridiculous Rock Record Reviews page and sign up on one of the monthly tiers. Feel free to leave all of your feedback, comments, reviews, and or suggestions at any of those places I just described. We'd love to hear from you. So for the R4 Podcast, I'm Aaron.
I'm the Professor.
And I'm Lou.
See ya. Many miles away.
Many miles away.
A cyclic arpeggiated fingered guitar pack. Duh. A cyclic. Why do I do this to myself? Why do you pick that word? Yeah, right. Because it's the only, it's that, their thing.